I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
It's time to get outside. This is KSL Outdoors, brought to you by Trax Power Sports Rentals. 2 hours of stories and information about hunting, fishing, and high adventure. It's KSL Outdoors with host Tim Hughes on KSL News Radio 102.7 FM and 1160 AM.
And good morning. Hour number two is ready to go here, the final one for the show each and every week. And it's always right on time for the sun just to poke its head up over the Wasatch Mountain Range on what will be a beautiful day. Why does that make you laugh?
Well, for a couple reasons.
That you're not going to share with us.
Like it's right on time, only for maybe a month.
Yeah. You know? Well, that's true. Anyway, nice to have you with us. Tim Hughes along with Russ Smith.
Hey,
from
good morning.
Sky Call.
Good to be here.
You were telling me during the news that Craig Gordon just brought back all the phones from the Avalanche Center.
Yeah, we had a nice discussion.
One of the couple of times we get to see him when he's not out in the field.
It's rare, isn't it?
Yeah. But you had a great long conversation about all the aspects of what they do all winter long.
What people could have done better those people are no longer with us. You know.
Yeah.
And the fatalities, he gave me the stats, and I should have written them down, but I was surprised at how many fatalities we had, but surprised that we had that many, but also surprised that we didn't have more the season with the amount of snow that we had all over the place.
One of the statistics you shared that is not a surprise to me is that most of those problems come from people on snowmobiles, and we've said it for years that the technology gets you into places you should not be. And then you're in trouble, and it's too late to actually know, and people aren't trained in things like avalanche recovery and search and all that.
I'll give you a quick example of what the problem is. Three guys go on snowmobiles, or gals, doesn't matter. They get in the backcountry, have an avalanche, their buddy's buried. One guy forgot his probe, okay? One guy forgot a shovel.
Yeah.
And they have no way to call in any emergency services. They're wearing beacons. So they know about where the guy's at, where to start digging. So somebody's got to get on a snowmobile drive out. So that's one less person to dig.
Of course, what do they say the average time to find somebody and save them is minutes? You're not going to get anybody there in time to help.
Right.
However, you are going to have some other recovery.
But let's say you did recover the victim.
With injuries.
Yeah, with injuries. You want medevac there waiting.
And that's where Sky Call Satellite comes in.
It does.
If you don't have cell service.
Wherever you can buy the equipment. I'm happy to accommodate anybody, but, you know, a tracker, a phone, whatever it takes to get hold of emergency services.
And if you've got adventures planned in the outdoors soon, remember to get Sky Call involved with for safety reasons for you in the outdoors and for selfish reasons on our part to be able to share those experiences.
We'd like to hear from you, you know.
Just call Russ at 801-450-8317.
You know it better than I do.
That's why I do it.
Thank you.
Also here this morning, Taylor Powers.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Always good to see you.
Happy to be here.
And people need to know that during the week, when you're not out playing in the outdoors, skiing or mountain biking, you're actually upstairs somewhere in this building, aren't you?
Yep.
I work on the digital side.
I work on the digital side for KSL Broadcast. Help make the station money.
Yeah, exactly. Help pay the bills around here. And we're learning all these new terms like snipes and all these things that are in the digital world these days. Nice to have you this morning. Charlie Jennings also here from, and remind people where they find you.
Bear River Outfitters, 435-764-1111.
And we're going to talk about this Volandre coat coming up here in a minute, which is fantastic. And thanks to Matt Jalalian, who is always with us. I've kind of enjoyed the kid cams that are watching watching Reed try and sleep in his crib at home.
I enjoy watching him sleep as well, which is something he's doing less and less of now.
I was going to say, that's because he drives you nuts when he's not sleeping.
Oh, my gosh. I don't want to say too much because I know we're running low on time. But
and his mother's listening.
Yesterday was poopocalypse, and it was the worst. And it just was terrible.
The poopocalypse.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, details of that are left unsaid. Had a chance a couple of days ago to catch up with Covey Jones. He's the Division of Wildlife Big Game Coordinator. Happy to have Covey Jones with us. He is our Wildlife Big Game Coordinator, and we've got him on for the next couple of minutes. Several things we wanted to talk about, Covey. I know that the Wildlife Board met on Thursday, and we'll get to some of the recommendations for numbers of hunting permits in just a minute. But if we can we flash back to the last hunting season? I know you've got some stats and figures to talk about as far as number of permits and the success rate of hunters this last year.
Yeah, so, you know, deer hunting in Utah the last 3 years has been great. This last year, we still harvested over 30,000 bucks, issued 90,000 permits, you know, about 30% success overall in general season, and that was up from 2018. A lot of deer on the landscape right now. If we look back to 8 or 9 years ago, we were sitting at high 200s, 280,000 deer. And today, you know, the model population estimate for 2018 was just over 370,000. So we've grown, you know, 90,000 deer in the state of Utah for the last 7 or 8 years. And overall, we're in a good place. Now, this last winter was a little bit of a different story. But yeah, we can talk about that too, if you'd like to.
Yeah. First of all, put those numbers into perspective for me. I guess too much of a good thing is too much of a bad thing for deer herds in the state of Utah. It's sort of a delicate balance, is it not?
It is. It is. You know, in Utah, it's expected. Our public wants a lot of deer on the landscape, and so a lot of the deer populations run right at or around carrying capacity. You know, and it's sometimes a hard thing to explain, but really, we don't harvest a lot of does in the state. And if you don't harvest does, and every doe is being bred and having the opportunity to have a fawn, and you're not growing, you have to look at other factors. And what could those other factors be? And it's probably some density dependence and some carrying capacity. Well, this last year, we came into winter off a severe drought. And coming in off a severe drought and then having a more severe winter, we lost a lot of deer in portions of the state. We lost a lot of adults and a lot of fawns both. And I think the only thing is, if there's a silver lining at all, in the areas that were hit the hardest, some of our northern areas, the deer we lost were over 7.5 years old. They're the less productive deer.
Huh.
And so at this point, we're really set up to bounce back well. We've had great spring moisture, good body condition, hopefully a good fawn crop, and then come into that and have high survival this next year, since we've gotten rid of some of that density dependence issues that we see.
Yeah, and some of the highest mortality rates, if I read the statistics right, were Cache and Camas and the Chalk Creek areas. Is that right?
Yeah. So on the Cache, that is one of our survival units, and it's set up to monitor survival. The Camas and the Chalk Creek, we put out quite a few callers there this last year. You know, and I just, since I'm a biologist and a scientist, I have to always put the qualify in there. The Camas and Chalk Creek, we got survival on those callers, but that study was designed to look at migration. So statistically, the percentages there, yeah, we know we had heavy losses, but the margin of error on the caller data there is not as strong. So, but definitely deer were impacted in those areas and set back.
You know, sometimes I get the feeling that hunters want the division to wave a magic wand and have certain things happen with populations in certain parts of the state, and they are really critical of some of the moves made by the division. But, man, when you're dealing with exactly what you just talked about, and that is nature taking its course and Mother Nature being uncontrollable, you went from a nasty drought situation, which causes problems for these herds, immediately into a crazy winter year, which causes a whole nother round of problems. You just can't compensate for that.
No, you can't, Tim. And we knew we were going to have problems this winter. You know, when we catch in December and look at body condition, and we saw the body condition these deer were in northern Utah because of the drought, and areas across the state because of the drought, we knew that it could be a tough winter right then. and then to have it followed up by the amount of snow we got. And we needed the moisture. You know, it is this delicate balancing act. I think the one thing I would echo is that the division wishes it had a magic wand sometimes too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
All right. But overall numbers, you were in the 300 plus thousand range. How does that compare to where you want it to be or where we would like it to be?
You know, the goal in the statewide management plan is 425,000. So we still have units that are under population objective. And we're working hard to address those limiting factors. But again, you said this, we don't have the magic wand. As we go out and do our survival studies, we get cause specific mortality on what is limiting a population, why aren't they growing? And we're trying to address those one by one. But it's a tough thing to get at.
Yeah.
Always nice to have more deer.
Yeah. What can you tell us about the board decisions this past week regarding permits and the numbers of permits in certain parts of the state?
I can tell you the board went really, really well. We're very fortunate in Utah to have a great public process where we get input across the state, local input from hunters that hunt their favorite units, their backyards. They're able to show up at the regional advisory council meetings, give input there, and then give input to the board. Overall, a few changes the board made. You know, there's some concern on the Manti, a portion of the Manti, reduced some general season deer permits there, added a few bighorn sheep permits to the Zion. Public sentiment was they wanted some additional permits there. It fit within the management plan, and the board made that addition and rearranged some antlerless hunts. But not many big changes from what came out in the RAC packet 6 weeks ago.
And so the takeaway for hunters then is what exactly?
It's going to be a good year, hopefully a good year to hunt. Issuing almost 90,000 deer permits, again, just under 90,000 deer permits. Increased opportunity in limited entry elk. Increased opportunity in pronghorn moose, bighorn sheep. The only one I can think of that we decreased a few permits on was mountain goats, and that's when our survey data came in this last year for mountain goats. Even though we have a new plan that allows us to offer more opportunity, the populations, the census was down, and so not issuing quite as few mountain goat permits this year. Everything else is up overall.
That's great. I also saw a headline not long ago about the money raised through the conservation permits that are out there. And again, it tends to be a controversial thing. And if somebody's just looking at the numbers that maybe hunters from outside the state, rich guys, are coming in and throwing huge amounts of money at, they get frustrated. But man, when you look at the bottom line numbers of this, and this is just last year's numbers, 2018, this Utah Conservation Permit Program generated almost $4.6 million. And to put that into perspective, if not for the revenue from these permits, the state would have to substantially raise hunting permit prices for residents and offer a larger percentage of high-cost permits to non-residents. And the DWR, according to these statistics, currently issues more than 90% of Utah's limited entry permits to Utah hunters through its hunt drawings. And those conservation permits, by the way, that are made available at the expo permits, where you can actually, for a $5 application fee, have a chance at getting one of these once-in-a-lifetime opportunities, I think is something everybody should be applauding.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. And you know, they always say that you never understand something until you deal with it every day. And conservation permit monies and budgets, we benefit from those every day. We use those for a lot of our population census. That money restores habitat across the state, builds water sources, restores winter range and summer range. And I personally see how much more we get done for Utah because we have that program. And not to discount the fact that Utah residents do give up something to let the division manage the conservation permit program. And we're thankful for that. But I hope that everybody can at some point either ask about it or see the benefits we get from those.
Yeah, and there's lots of ways to find that information. If you have questions about it, there are great press releases available on the website, just wildlife.utah.gov. You can see specific numbers, where the money went, what the projects did, who's participating in these things, and the money raised is really quite impressive. And it would be interesting for those that have such a negative feedback on it, you know, where they think those funds would come from, if not from this program.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Cubby, thanks. We're out of time, but I sure appreciate checking in with you from time to time, and thanks for the update on the board meeting this week. We'll look forward to getting together with you again soon.
All right. Thanks for the call, Tim, and come back. We'll have to talk deer survival someday.
We'll do that. We'll take a break here, and when we get back, we will have more of KSL Outdoors Radio, so don't go away. All right, welcome back. Our thanks to Cubby Jones for his time today. We're going to get back together with him real soon. He was telling me as we wrapped up our conversation about the fact that the Division of Wildlife Resources in Utah, way ahead of the curve on many other states, most other states, we might even be leading the country with some of the things they're doing right now. He wants to make sure our listeners are aware of. Charlie Jennings is with us, though, and we wanted to talk about, among other things, this Velandre coat that you brought in. Has Taylor tried that on?
I know tried it on. I was swimming in it.
Not really your size, but you can attest to the fact of how light that thing is.
Oh, yeah, super light. And it's, what did you say, it's a 0 degree?
Yeah.
In Utah, not Minnesota.
Yeah. It's cozy.
Why would you say in Utah, not Minnesota?
Wisconsin. My son lived in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. We went out there and the wind was blowing 10, 20 miles an hour. It just cuts you to the bone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we're drier out here, so it doesn't feel as bone chilling.
It's a dry heat and it's a dry cold. but why are these Velandres so special? Now, they are more costly, obviously, but when people, you know, try it on and see the difference, I guess that's why you are willing to pay the price, right?
Well, the thing is, you can't really tell the quality by looking at it on a website or in a catalog.
Yeah.
You just can't once you put it on. Velandre is based in France, and the guy, the designer, Niels, is such a perfectionist. He's won numerous European outdoor
awards.
Well,
you said he's like a custom tailor.
He is. He's crazy. He'll get the 900 fill goose down, which is really hard to get, and the cost of the down itself just goes up astronomically, but he just never scrimps. He's got a lot of compartments in it. It's baffled, but yet it compresses down to the size of almost an Nalgene bottle.
Yeah.
And it may be a little hot for skiing, but after skiing, you know, when you're sitting around, it's incredibly warm.
That was one of the first questions I asked you, is would this actually be good for, you know, skiing on a cold day here in Utah? And you said because of the aerobic activity, you might really get overheated in this thing.
You'd roast. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is a good sign for people that, you know, get cold in the winter.
Yeah.
We have plenty of cold days, and man, I had some ski days. Taylor did too this year, where you get to the top, 10,000 feet, if you're up at, you know, Hidden Peak or something, and the wind is blowing up there. We had 40 or 50 mile an hour winds. Holy cow. Yeah. That's a cold day. But a coat like that would help keep you warm and not weigh you down.
No, they've actually tested it. Some of the mountaineer clients that they sponsor have actually tested this coat in Antarctica, you know, one of their parkas.
Yeah. I think it's a mistake on their part, just marketing-wise, that the perception is that only people that are going to go climb Mount Everest or do canyoneering in really obscure places in the world like Antarctica buy these kinds of coats, and that's not the fact, is it?
No. I mean, these are – no, you don't need to be a mountaineer or a climber to buy one of these. They're wonderful. It's just amazing. One of the problems with down jackets these days, they're made in Asia. The goose down is a premature goose, and they break down easy. These come from Eastern Europe.
So they have a short life is what you're saying.
Yeah, they do. I mean, this jacket will last me 30 years. They sent this to me to field test it. And it's my favorite jacket. It's just, yeah, it's amazing.
But retail price on something like that?
It's big. It's like $699.
Yeah.
But, you know, how many hunters spend $3,000 on binoculars and spotting scopes? You know?
How many people spend $3,000 on a mountain bike? We've talked about that today.
It's all relative.
Yeah, things that are going to last you a long time in the outdoors are going to cost you. We usually talk or sometimes talk about tents with you.
Right.
But tents, coats, those kinds of things, or sleeping bags is the other one. As we head into camping season, if you're going to make an investment, make an investment. Because if you're going to buy cheap, you're going to end up doing that three or four times, and you might as well have bought one that would last you all those years anyway.
Well, not only that, but it can save your life. I know bighorn sheep hunters that are up at, you know, on top of the ridge, and the wind's blowing 80 miles an hour, and the material is inferior, and their tent will literally shred, and the poles will break.
Yeah.
And the Hilleberg, one of the things that Petra, who's the new CEO for Hilleberg, in Seattle, she says, we don't do flimsy, and they never have.
Yeah. So. Well, you don't want to be, and I had this experience that I've shared on the show before. We were at the very beginning of a 12-day float down the Kinnickuk River in Alaska, self-guided, and we're sitting in a tent on right on a lake up there, and the wind comes up, one of those great Alaska storms. We were the last float plane in, and as the float plane left, you have this feeling of, okay, man, something goes bad, you're on your own. Then we realized that somebody had not brought the stakes to put the tent in the ground. And when the winds came up, it was a one of those dome tents, but the winds were strong enough, it was collapsing on us from the top, and we'd have to push it back up.
Yeah, it's scary.
All night long, we were sitting up on each of the post sites around the outside of the tent with driving rain, keeping the tent from collapsing on us and keeping it on the ground. I mean, those are the moments you don't want to find out you didn't pay enough for a good tent.
No, yeah.
And we were glad to have the one we had. Would have been nice to have the stakes to keep it on the ground. But, yeah. All right, but you carry the good stuff.
I do.
And you specialize in that.
Yeah, I guess I'm kind of OCD that way. I just don't like products that scrimp, Hilleberg. You know, you can go on and look at the reviews on trailspace.com. Everybody loves Hilleberg.
Yeah.
Just because they're made. Valandre, Western Mountaineering sleeping bags, they're phenomenal.
And a lot of retailers don't carry it because they know that it's sort of a niche market for them. And, you know, they want to have good price points to get people through the door.
It's a lot of money to put on the shelf.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. It's and one of the things, too, is that some of these companies hire young men and women that they don't have the personal experience.
To explain why it costs that.
Right.
Yeah.
And so people are welcome to call me, and if they need 30 minutes to talk, let's talk about gear.
All right, and how do they do that?
435-764-1111, Bear River Outfitters.
Bear River Outfitters. I haven't said this, but since you were public with it on your social media, we're glad you're here for several reasons. Not always good to see you, but
nice to see you alive.
Yeah, you had a little struggle with pneumonia and some other problems not long ago.
You know, I was going to say it's great to be here, but really it's great to be anywhere.
Yeah. We're glad you're feeling better and back on your feet.
Yeah, that was tough.
We need to break for news. We'll do that when we come back. Roger Eggett from Bear River Lodge, and then we'll tell you about this name change coming for a good friend of ours, Fred Hayes. State Park name change coming with a ribbon cutting on Tuesday. Stay with us.